All right, good morning. This week we read the Sedra of Vayetze, a Sedra which finds Yaakov Avinu in Golos, in exile, a precursor of our experiences in exile, and therefore at the heart of the Sedra is Yaakov's dealing with his father-in-law, Lavan. Lavan represents a very unique personality. Vayetze focuses on Lavan. He met him originally in Chayisara when he came to greet Eliezer and was involved in the selection of Rivka to be Yitzchak's wife, but now we encounter him again. And the question we have to understand is, what's bothering Lavan? Lavan seems to have a chip on his shoulder from the beginning of the Sedra to the very end. Now, he presents to us almost as a cartoon character of a person who is so duplicitous, so scheming, a compulsive liar, that you can't pin him down. And one would think that he would even recognize that. And yet he never does. So really, what's bothering him? He seems like such an obvious liar from the very beginning. So the Torah says in Perek Chavtes, that Yaakov comes by Pasuk Gimel, by Hishma Lavan as Shema Yaakov and Achosel, and Lavan hears the announcement Yaakov has come, Yaakov his nephew, by Yoratz Likraso, by Yechabeklo, by Yenashaklo, by Yviyel Beso. He runs to greet him, he embraces him, he kisses him, he brings him into his house. And Rashi says, the famous Rashi, that Lavan was not sincere. Well, he wouldn't know it from the embracing and the kissing. He was not sincere, but rather he was frisking Yaakov, searching him. Rashi says in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Kasavar Mamon Huton. Maybe he's bearing some valuables. Shehare Eved Habayis Balakan Basra Gamalim Tehinim. The servant of Avram's household came with 10 camels laden with goodies, bless you, with valuables. So obviously the grandson of this tycoon is going to have even greater riches on him. And yet Yaakov came without any camels at all, so he figured he must be carrying it. So he hugged him, he frisked him, he kissed him. Rashi says, maybe Sheva Margolios Hevi Vehem Befiv, maybe he concealed these precious stones in his mouth. And then he found out that Yaakov had nothing, but it seems so obvious. Then Yaakov and Lavan enter into an arrangement for marriage of his daughter. Vayehav Yaakov es Rachel Vayomer, it's Pasuk Yud Ches. Yaakov loved Rachel and he said, Evadcha Sheva Shanim, I'll work for 7 years. B'Rachel, B'tcha Haktana, for Rachel, your younger daughter. What could be clearer? So again, the Medrash says, Rashi highlights it here, that maybe you'll think, I'll just say Rachel, and you'll bring some other girl named Rachel. I'll say your daughter, you'll have another daughter, you'll name her Rachel too. Haktana. So every type of indication that this is the person that I'm talking about, that's what Yaakov utilized. And yet, it also wasn't enough. So, as we know, he switched Leah for Rachel. And in Pasuk Chafei, when after Yaakov protests, the Lomarini Sani, why did you deceive me? Vayomer Lavan, Pasuk Chavav, Lo Yeosechein Bimkomeinu. We don't do these things in our parts. Well, says Hatzi'ira Lefnei Havachira, to give away the younger daughter before the elder daughter. We don't do that. So, what kind of answer is that? I mean, who is he fooling? Yaakov said, Lomari Misani, at least admit you changed the terms. No, he doesn't even admit that. He says, we don't do these things. You should have known. Lo Yeosechein Bimkomeinu. And then Yaakov, after this, begins to work for Lavan. And again, he goes to, and this is a really good part of the Sedra, he goes to great lengths to specify what type of wages he wants. Begins in Pasuk Chavches, Perek Lamed. Vayomar, Lavan said to Yaakov, Nokvos Chorcha Olai Ve'Eteinos. So after the 14 years of service were completed, Lavan wants Yaakov to continue because Lavan saw that he was very successful. Nichashti, Vayavachin Hashem Biglalecha. God has blessed me on your account. So Lavan wanted Yaakov to continue in his employ, to specify your wage. But Yomer loves Yaakov says, you know everything I've done, everything that you've given me. You trust me, your cattle is with me. The little that I started with has now been augmented tremendously. God has blessed you because of me. So what do you want? Don't give me anything. What do you mean don't give me anything? Why don't you arrange a salary? You'll work a week, one cow per week. That's very low. Two cows per week. Make an arrangement. No? Yaakov says, I don't want you to give me anything from what you have. Rather, Evor Bechol Tzoncho Hayom, I'll pass through your flock, your sheep today. Haser Misham Kosed Nakod V'talu V'chol Sechum Baksavin V'talu V'nakod Boizim V'yoschari. So it's a little ambiguous, but what he means is you'll take out all the spotted and speckled sheep and goats that you have, anything brown amongst your animals, you'll take them out, and then I will be left with, essentially, solid colored animals. What those animals will breed, that's what I will keep. Meaning, I'll put myself at a disadvantage, because usually solid animals will breed solid animals, and speckled. I'll put myself at a disadvantage. Take out from the flock everything which if it appears in the future will be my wage, and from that my wage will come. And Lavan agrees. So in fact, Lavan sends his, and of course the assumption is that the spotted and the speckled and the brown animals are the abnormal animals. They're the minority amongst the animals. Most animals come out solid. So Lavan has his sons remove all the animals that Yaakov could covet for the future. And even more than that happens. It turns out, as we note later in the Sedra, when Yaakov finally explodes and challenges his father-in-law, he says in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Mem Aleph, Ze li esrim shenu b'veisecho. I'm now 20 years in your house. Avaticha arba'asre shana b'shtevin osecha. I work 14 years for your two daughters. B'sheshen b'tzonecha. This arrangement that was 6 years for your flock. V'kachalefes maskurti aseres monim. You changed my wage. Rashi says aseres is not asara. Asara is 10. Aseres is 10 squared. 100 times you changed my wages. Meaning, if they had agreed that Yaakov would keep the spotted and speckled, and there'd be a bumper, fertile crop of spotted and speckled, Lavan would say, no, we agreed on the solid. And if it was a solid, we agreed on the speckled. If it was white, we said brown. Brown, we said white. 100 times over 6 years. It's a lot. And one question is, why did Yaakov put up with all this? But the broader question is, what is love? What kind of person is he? He's such an obvious cheater, and yet he never lets on. He's relentless in his assertion of his own ethical standards. He never lets on that he, at the least, is guilty of anything wrong. Yaakov somehow is constantly misunderstanding. But tachleifes maskuti aseres on him. I doubt very much any of us would put up with an employer who unilaterally changed the terms of our contract 2 times, 3 times, much less 100 times in just 6 years. And yet Yaakov did. So why didn't he ask for a normal wage? And what is really the limud here? What is the Torah telling us in devoting such a good chunk of the Sedra, and reflectively such a good chunk of the Torah, on just these experiences between Yaakov and Lavan? finally, the Torah says that after experiencing this and becoming successful nonetheless, Yaakov, as the Torah says, devised a method somewhat mysterious to us in Perek Lamed Pasuk Lamed Zayin Lamed Ches. Yaakov saw that his wages were changing, so he had all these solid animals, and he devised a means, Makal Livne, Lach, Veluz, Ve'armon, Vayifatzel, Behem, Salos, Livanos, Machsof, Alavon, Asher, Lamaklos. He took an almond with chestnuts and, I'm sorry, a staff with chestnuts and almonds and other things, almost to induce these solid animals somehow, Bashgocha, to produce speckled animals. And that's what happened. So he was able to manipulate the fertility of his flock in order that he should get a wage. And it worked. He was constantly shifting based on what Laban was lying. Yaakov was responding until he became very wealthy at the end of Perek Lamed, Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Vayifrotzish mod mod. Vayish, not even Yaakov anymore. Became a gavra, wealthy person. Extraordinarily wealthy. He became a magnet on his own. And the sons of Lavan heard about all this, and they said, Yaakov took everything that belongs to our father. Yaakov's great wealth came from us. It's not him. It's not his hard work. It's not his even his tactics. He just stole it from our father. Yaakov is a parasite. So this, of course, we already see the harbinger of the future, that it's a classic attack of Jew haters throughout history, that how did we get wealthy? We're parasitic. We're stealing from them. That any wealth that belongs to a Jew, it has to be because he stole it from a non-Jew, did not earn it. This was very common in medieval times. Nazis really lodged the same accusation against the Jews in the 20s and 30s. The success of the Jew is because he steals from the non-Jew. And that, by the way, fuels part of the grievance in the Arab world today. It fuels it. Since most of them live in poverty, and they see Israeli society as progressive and modern and successful, so it's because they are stealing from the Arabs. Yes. Right. So the question is, why did Yaakov stay after that? That is a good question. Why did he stay? The simple answer is that where was he going to go? His brother Esav, as far as he knew, wanted to kill him. So he couldn't go home. He had received no word that he should come home. So he's essentially a man without a country, a man without a place to live. He knew, as a nomad. Yes and no. See, going to a stranger posed other dangers. You see, remember Yitzchak had told Yaakov to go to Lavan. All right? Yaakov was anything but the dutiful son. He went to Lavan for a reason, that among the dangers that presented, Lavan's danger was significant, but probably lesser than he'd face elsewhere. Because now he was in a more or less controlled framework. A shepherd always lives in a controlled framework because he's basically a loner. And he had his wives, and he had his sons. Granted, he had his father-in-law hovering over him, cheating him, but comparing that to living with someone else who was much more ruthless, overtly ruthless, than Lavan, would have apparently been a greater danger. So he stayed there. But now we're talking a short time, because after he married Rachel, then he was there for 6 years. Now, granted also, during those 6 years, during the 13 years after his marriage to Leah, he was quite fecund in producing children. So he had many young children who were not yet suitable to traveling or to living a nomadic existence. So he basically was homebound. The better question, not that yours is not a good question, but the better question is, why was Lavan so unhappy? Lavan hears that Yaakov leaves, and he's furious. So again, Vayar Yaakov, his Pnei Lavan, Yaakov sees Laban's face, and Laban's not the same anymore, because Yaakov has all this wealth. And then he gets a tzivui min Hashem, shuv el eretz avosech u'motecho, v'yeimach. Now it's time to go back. Calls his wives in, and he tells them why they have to go back, and in fact they start to leave, and Rachel and Leah, pasuk yud dalid, they have no qualms about leaving. Vatan Rachel v'Leah v'tomar nolo, ha'od lonu chelek v'nachalo b'veis avinu. Do we still have any share or portion in our father's house? Halo nochrios nechshavnu lo ki mecharano. He treats us like strangers, like aliens, when he sold us. V'yochal gamachol es kaspenu. He consumes our wealth. All the wealth that God saved. Kol ha'osha sheitzil elokim avinu lonu hul vanenu. V'atakah asher amar elokim elecha say. We'll do whatever you say. We can't live with our father anymore either. But Yaakov leaves, and in fact, Lavan becomes very angry. Finally catches up to Yaakov, and the Torah expresses the depth of Lavan's emotion. How it almost sounds sincere. It almost sounds sincere. How angry Lavan is that Yaakov would dare to leave him. So the question is, where does all that come from? Where does Lavan get this rage from? This resentment. What's that? Yeah, but he was the same way before. I mean, and you think also he would be able to face that at a certain point. That here he's cheating him constantly, and essentially, like Laurie said, he goes take another job, basically. He's going home. So what is the anger? And it's not as if he took anything that didn't belong to him, except for one thing. Yes. That Lavan could manipulate Yaakov, and now he can't anymore. But the thing is, you can understand the rage, it's true, but Lavan never lets on that he's doing anything wrong. You have to understand that the unique type of rishus that Lavan represents, he's a very special type of rasha. He's not the typical rasha. With one other question. Arami Avedavi, that's right. With one other question, and that is, why did Rachel steal the Tefachim? Why did she steal her father's idols? I mean, why now? Here they're living there for quite a while. Steal them while you're there, or talk them out of it or something. Why steal them in such a way that their father would notice? Question is, what is Lavan's dominant trait? What drives Lavan? I mean, what's at the root of his personality? So there's one Nidara we'll get to, but there is an approach that it's important to mention that I heard from my Rebbe, Rabbi Chait. It's important to mention because this is the uniqueness of the rishus of Lavan, which is part of the phenomenon of Jews in exile and in Eretz Yisrael. There are really two types of rishon that we deal with. There's the rasha who's the brute, who's the animalistic, who operates through the Nefesh HaBahami. That's one type of Rasha, and his evil is recognizable, because you see him coming, can't always protect yourself, but at least you see him coming. There's a far more cunning type of Rasha, and that's the Rasha who uses Chochmah, who uses wisdom in pursuit of evil. That type of Rasha, who's very sophisticated, very urbane, double-talking, duplicitous, he not only wants to cheat you, but he wants to maintain the veneer of respectability, as if it's your fault. You didn't understand. You are really the one who's cheating. That he's justified in everything that he does, and you're justified in nothing that you do. That he's done nothing wrong. It's like, it's not even that far-fetched an analogy. It's like the prototype now, the model that we have set up with the Arabs over the last 15 years. If Jews kill Arabs, then it's the Jews' fault, because they kill the Arabs. And if Arabs kill Jews, well, it's the Jews' fault, because they're the occupiers, and they deserve to be killed. The common denominator is, it's always the Jews' fault. I saw a film clip of Arafat yesterday. He was interviewed in 1974, I think it was, when he came to 75 when he came to the 74 he came to the UN, and I'd forgotten. So I tried not to gaze at the face of a Russia. I'd forgotten what a big smile he always had, smiling. I am not a terrorist. The Israelis are the terrorists. That type of that utilization of cleverness in pursuit of attaining your goals, which results not just in the successful acquisition of what you want, but making the adversary feel that the adversary's wrong, defending yourself is wrong, insisting on your rights is wrong, self-protection is wrong. That is a very unique type of Russia, the one who speaks in terms of peace and tranquility and security and equal rights. That is a very, very dangerous Russia. That is the model of Lavan. Esav is more of a brute type of Russia. Yaakov offends him. I will kill him. I will wait until my father dies, and then I will kill him. So that Russia we understand. You flee, you hide, you hope you're successful. Lavan is very difficult. But Lavan never lets on that he's wrong about anything. On the contrary, he has a very unctuous habit of making his adversary feel that somehow the adversary was wrong, that the adversary is the unethical one for insisting on certain rights. Gemara says in Makos, Daf Chav Dalad, that Rabbi Kiva and his Chaverim, a famous story before the more famous story of the fox and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but the story which precedes that, they were standing on a hilltop and they heard at a great distance the hordes of the Roman army. Very powerful, deafening sound. And they looked and they saw in the distance the great might of that army. And as the Gemara says, the Chaverim of Rabbi Akiva, they began to cry. And Rabbi Akiva began to laugh. So he said to them, why are you crying? So he said, why am I crying? Why are you laughing? So he said, they said, we're crying because you see this army that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and exiled God's people and the most powerful army, we see that, we're under their foot. We shouldn't cry. To which Rabbi Akiva said that that's exactly why I'm laughing. Im le'ovre ritzono kach, le'ose ritzono alachas kama v'chamo. If God rewards those who violate His will this way, so those who obey God's will, how much more so will they be rewarded? That's why he left. What's the pshat? So my Rebbe said as follows, Im la'ovre ritzono kach. You see, the Romans were brutes, but they were a sophisticated army. They knew exactly what they were doing. They had a very orderly system of government. They had for centuries at a time stability. They had a legal system. They had an army. They had a plan. They utilized chokhmah within the framework of reality. So therefore, they achieved a measure of success. So Rabbi Akiva said, Im la'ovre ritzono kach, if a person achieves a modicum of success in rishus by using his God-given intelligence for the wrong purposes, but by using that intelligence, le'ose ritzono alachas kama v'chamo, how much more so will be the reward of the tzaddik whose entire life is governed by chokhmah and who lives in reality and is attached to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how much more so is his schar? Yet, le'ovre ritzono kach, it's very possible that a rasha uses his God-given chokhmah for nefarious ends and achieves partial success in this world. That's possible. Yaakov Avinu saw this right away. Yaakov Avinu knew at the very beginning, even from when his mother, I'm sure he heard about his uncle from his mother. You know, parents always talk about the siblings. So when he heard about Lavan, he knew what to expect. So in Perek Chavtes, at the very first encounter, the Torah says, Vayageid Yaakov Rachel, ki achi aviyahu, v'chi ven rifkohu. Yaakov said to Rachel that I'm your father's sister's son. Literally, achi aviyah, I'm your father's brother. Dechiven Rivka, I'm Rivka, your aunt's son, your first cousin. So Rashi says in Pasuk Yibbeis, Achi Aviyahu Midrasho, I'm really your father's brother. Im L'Rama'us Hubo, if he comes to deceive me, Gamani Achiv V'Rama'us, I can be his brother in deception as well. V'im Adam Kosherhu, Gamani Ben Rivka Chasak Shero. If he wants to treat me uprightly, you should know I'm the son of Rivka, the righteous. So Yaakov said to Rachel, he knows who her father is. And if he wants to play that game, I can play that game too. What's the problem? Nobody plays that game like Lavan. So what Yaakov did is try to utilize his own wisdom to counter any possible argument, any possible deception that Lavan could use. That's Evad Choshev Ashanim B'Rachel B'tcha Ktana. That's devising a unique means to earn his wages. Yaakov didn't want to take anything that Lavan had. Yaakov knew that Lavan would not want to part with it, so he decided just to take his wages out of future profits and have it speculative, not anything definite, so Lavan would not be able to cheat him. What's the problem? Lavan could justify any misconduct, any misdeed. He was very shifty, very devious. Why? Because when it came to crunch time, when it came to the exact point of conflict, he was always able to point to another factor, another phenomenon that you did not consider. Did you say, B'Rachel B'tcha Ktana? Of course you did. I agree with you. That was our arrangement. But, Lo Ya'osachem B'mkomeinu. He didn't realize the Minag HaMakom. Community custom is not like that. So even though there was a meeting of the minds between the two of them on every detail possible in that contractual relationship, nonetheless, Yaakov Avinu could never anticipate the external factor that arose only at the moment of deception that Lavan kept within his control. What did Lavan do? Lavan sold and resold a non-saleable commodity. Right? What's that? His daughters. Daughters are not for sale. In fact, you don't think that Rachel and Leah were sensitive to this? What exactly did they say to Yaakov in Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Tesvav? Halo nochrios nechshavnu lo ki micharanu. He treats us like strangers. Ki micharanu. He sells us. Lavan was so clever, he was able to sell and resell something which can't even be sold once and continue to extract a price for it. What does that remind you of? It's exactly what's happened in the last 10 years. In three separate agreements, the Arabs have won escalating concessions by promising not to commit acts of terror. Oslo 1, Oslo 2, why? The same thing. Each time they promise, they don't keep their promise, and they keep getting more concessions. So what are we awaiting now? There'll be new concessions. What's going to be the quid pro quo? Another promise not to commit acts of terror. It's the exact same thing. They're able to sell something that can't be sold, and yet they sell it again and again. And we're the buyers. Like Yaakov Avinu here was the buyer as well. Ki micharanu. The daughters say, he sold us. Where does all this come from? So what Midah Ra is really at the core of Lavan's personality? Greed. Greed in all its manifestations. You see, it's hard to be overtly greedy because people see through it. People see even through the covert greed pretty quickly, but to be overtly greedy, that puts people off. But Lavan presented a very warm personality. Lavan on the surface was very friendly, right? Lavan ran out to greet the Avram's Eved when he came. He runs out to greet Yaakov when he came. He's very magnanimous in his gestures. in his words, loved one was not devoid of emotion. On the contrary, in his own way, he loved his family, loved Yaakov, loved his daughters, loved his grandchildren. So Lavan also had a very big smile, constantly. But his friendliness is what facilitated his ability to deceive. And that is a not uncommon trait among Rishayim. They have to maintain that friendliness in order to win people over. So when Lavan spotted a particular individual, his mindset always was, what can I get out of this person? And how can I make that person want to give it to me? How about to take it from him? To take it from him, that's Nimrod, that's Esau. How do I make that person want to give me what I want from him? So Lavan had tools. His tools were his words. His tools were his appearance, his smile. That's his name, Lavan, white, like teeth. He's white. He shows a very bland but cheerful countenance. So a person could not help but like Lavan. Lavan reinforced community norms, as we see. Lavan was an attractive personality, a winning personality. He's a wealthy person. And yet, he was greedy. Now, Lavan could not part with anything. This is Chazal notes at the beginning of the Sedra, that when he sent his daughters out to have to challenge the other shepherds for water rights at the well, not even his sons. He'd send his daughters out, even though it was strenuous work. He had his sons do other things. Lavan, Yaakov knew, could not part with anything. And that, in fact, is why Yaakov said to Lavan, when he asked, Ma'etan lo, Yaakov said, Lo sikhen li me'uma, I don't want anything from you. You want to know what you pay me? Salary? Wages? Don't give me anything at all. Nothing. Because a greedy person cannot part with anything. It's like you're taking their blood. That's the word the Torah uses. One of the words for money is the same word as blood, damim. Because for some people, it's as hard to part with their money as it is with their blood. That Lavan was like that. So Yaakov knew if he would ask Lavan for a wage, that every week he'd have to give some of his capital, some of his earnings, then that would never fly. And Lavan could never accept that, and it would just bring out even more aggression. So what did Yaakov ask for? Nothing that Lavan had, but rather that which he did not yet have. I will devise a system whereby my earnings will come out of future profits, and therefore I need not take anything that belonged to you, and there'll be no grievances. I'll work for you, your flock will multiply, and I'll take a small percentage of the abnormal flock. What's the problem? The problem is that for a greedy person, for a rasha who has all the tools of rishus at his disposal, he can't even part with future profits. Things not yet in existence are also very difficult because you start to project. Look, my flock now produced 1,000, so why should I give him 100? I'll give him 10. I'll give him 20. And next year produces 2,000, I have to give him 200. No, I can't do that. That's he's just stealing from me. Yaakov put up with this. Why did he put up with it? I think for the same reason that many of us recognize. Yaakov thought that eventually he would be able to use his chokhmah to wear Lavan down. What does it mean, wear him down? Eventually, he would have to be pinned down and concede that he's done something wrong. Admit that he is a Rachel. Admit, just say the words that when I said, Rachel Bitraktana, there was a meeting of the minds, and you changed your mind, admit that. Yaakov thought eventually Lavan would have to agree that we had a deal on wages. He said, Nakvos chacha alai v'etena, you give it to me. Just admit that you changed something. Admit that you've changed one detail. Admit that you lied. Yaakov, Titain Emesli Yaakov, the man of truth, could not fathom that there'd be a person so devoid of truth so disdainful of truth that he could never admit that he's done something wrong, that he's even changed the contract. But Lavan couldn't, because Lavan would not want to lose face, so therefore he could never concede. Lavan could never admit. If you notice, one of the things that the Arabs always ask for in all the agreements is that Israel should admit that they drove out the refugees and they're sitting on occupied land. That's uniform in every agreement. They don't only want the land, they want the admission that you're wrong. That's what Lavan did. Lavan wants a constant admission that Yaakov is the one who's wrong, that Yaakov is not understanding, that Yaakov is the one who's trying to cheat Lavan. What? Lavan always pretends to act in an ethical framework. He's governed by international law. Lavan is the one who's following the norms of the society. It's not that Lavan, am breaching the norms of society. You, Yaakov, are breaching the norms of society. You're the one. You don't understand. Look, I have all the my families behind me, my sons. They're the ones who recognize that this kol asher ma'asher lo'avinu also is called a kavod hazeh. Something is not right. If you're supposed to take a small percentage of the profits, then how is it that you're so wealthy? How is that possible? An employee should be as wealthy as the employer. How can that be? Lavan is always able to twist the tables. Lo ye'osechem ben komenu. That's not the tzibur. It's not the minig hamakom. Lavan always had a rationalization by which his behavior could be understandable to him and to the segment of mankind that is as oleaginous as he is. Yes, ma'am. It's a good point. It almost reinforces his, well, it's giving him a taste of his own medicine on the one hand, but it's also reinforcing to Lavan that Yaakov is stealing. That's right. That could be why Yaakov reacted with such passion when Lavan accused him of stealing, that something is missing. And in fact, we discussed this once before, I think 3 years ago, Yaakov took this oath that... It's in Pasuk, Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk, let's see, where is it? Pasuk Lamed Beis. Im asher timsos Elohecha lo yichya. Yaakov Avinu knew that he would not steal, couldn't imagine anyone else would steal, so whoever is in possession of your gods, lo yichya, they should die. Neged achenu, Hakern lecha mo imadi v'kach loch. Go with your brethren and search out whatever belongs to you. Take. V'lo yada Yaakov ki Rachel genovasam. Yaakov could not imagine that Rachel had taken it. Why? We'll discuss in a moment. But Yaakov thought at a certain point, like we do, by the way. We're no different than Yaakov. We're the Bnei Yaakov. at a certain point, they have to admit that they lie, they cheat, they deceive, they don't fulfill agreements. At a certain point, someone's going to get on television and say, you know, Chatasi, Chatanu, Avinu. We didn't do the right thing, right? You never find that. It's very interesting. You know, I don't watch many of the left-wing news shows anymore, but I remember Nightline years ago. Nightline's idea of balance always to have an Arab bashing Israel and a Jew bashing Israel. That was the balance. But you know, it's an interesting phenomenon that you'll find Israelis are more or less objective, sometimes even prejudiced against Israel, appear on American television. You never find a pro-Israel Arab. Never find someone to go on a talk show, an Arab. That's why, I mean, when they do emerge to anybody, when they do emerge, they're marginalized. We know who they are. Joseph Farah, he's a Lebanese-American columnist, very pro-Israel. Well, he's a Persian, but he's not pro-Israel necessarily. you know, the Arabs have turned a lot of people off, a lot of intellectuals the last few years. But I mean pro-Israel Arabs. There's one fellow, someone gave me the other day in shul, a biography of this former PLO terrorist named Walid Shoibat. Have you heard of him? I heard him 2-3 years ago. You heard of him?
Yes, yeah, I think he spoke with Gabriella.
That's right. That's right. That's right. She? I'm sorry, about he was PLO terrorist.
He was a former terrorist.
That's right. He was okay. He was a bomb maker, planted a bomb, and people were injured. This goes back to the 80s, I think. And then he married, he got out of prison, he married, and trying to convert his wife from Christianity to Islam, he started studying the Bible, and he recognized that the claims of the Jews to the land of Israel are true. So since then, the last 10-12 years, he's gone on a speaking tour, speaking on behalf of Israel against the Arabs. But it's you know, it's so unique. What's that? I don't know. Post office box.
There's a woman, Gabriella, I forget her last name, that spoke with more impressive than him.
Right.
That took out 4-page papers with very saying what Israel had accomplished, and that she'll probably speak for the Jews,
right, right.
And she was a Lebanese Christian. That right. That's exactly what happened when she lived in Lebanon.
Right. Nonetheless, see, he's Shoibat's a little different because he at least is a Palestinian. But nonetheless, these people are so rare, and they have almost no access to the mainstream media, even though their story is bizarre by modern standards. The pro-Israel Arab, how could such a thing be? I think they attract the same amount of attention that Naturi Karta does. Like the world at large, they don't understand the anti-Israel Jew. This doesn't make any sense. I've been in the company of Christians who've seen them demonstrating, and there's none understanding. It just doesn't sink in. What are they doing? It's the same thing. The anti-Israel Jew attracts as much attention as the pro-Israel Arab. It makes no sense. But in fact, the anti-Israel Jew, in terms of the political system, anti, but, you know, objective, they see the Arab side, they're trying to accommodate the accommodationists, the appeasers. They are a powerful group. They are a very powerful group. Lavan was the type of personality that could wear you down with words and arguments and his own value system, because he had a moral framework in which he operated. So he would never say to Yaakov, "I'm not paying you," like the ruthless employer does. He said, "Of course I'm paying you, but it's not the terms that we agreed to. It's a little different than what you thought they were." When Yaakov ran away, so that became the hostile act, because then Lavan felt betrayed. And he probably on some level sincerely felt betrayed, but every Russian knows himself, and surely Lavan recognized that at this point Yaakov had been pushed too far, and therefore when Yaakov left, it was tantamount to a declaration that Lavan is an insufferable Russia, and therefore I can no longer live with him. And that Lavan could not accept. And that's why he chased after Yaakov to bring him back, again saying to Yaakov, as only Lavan can, "Lama nachbeso livroach? Why did you sneak away to flee?" It's Pasuk Chav Zayin. "Vatignovo si, you stole me." Listen, of Gan of Brentos Hittel, the hat burns on the head of the thief. Who's the one who's stealing all these years? Lavan. And yet Yaakov says, "Vatignovo si, you stole from me. You stole my heart. Lo igadatoli, you didn't tell me you were leaving. I would have sent you away with great joy, with song, with the Nafshenu orchestra. We would have made a public ceremony that you're leaving." Only Lavan would be able to talk like that. Lavan's face changed when Yaakov became wealthy, because Lavan, from his mindset, assumed it could only be at his expense. So why did Rachel steal the trophim? So there is a tug of war going on in Lavan's house. between Emes and Sheker, between Yaakov and Lavan, between those two ideologies. Now, Lavan seems too clever a person to believe in idols. Lavan is very self-sufficient. How does he get what he wants? He connives. The conniving person is not necessarily the person drawn to icons and prayers and sacrifices. But Lavan used Trophim as a security blanket. That's common amongst the primitive idolaters, to hedge his bets. So therefore, in order to maintain his material situation, so Lavan had a relationship with the gods as well. But Rachel was leaving now. And Rachel knew that in this struggle, this ideological struggle in Lavan's house, as long as Yaakov was there, there was a chance, however small, but still a chance, that Lavan would recognize the godless of Yaakov, recognize Emes and Sheker, and in fact come to an understanding of the Borei Olam. As long as Yaakov was there, then there was still a chance for that. But when Yaakov left, with Yaakov gone, the only hope for Lavan, Rachel, the daughter, felt, was to shake him out of his mold, out of the box, the spiritual lethargy that he was in, and show him that his Avodah Zarah is useless. Lavan had to be awakened. Suddenly, a dramatic event, a transformation. And the way to do it, Rachel felt, was to steal the Trophim, much like the famous Medrash of Avraham Avinu and his father's idols. He broke them. Lavan would see how powerless his gods were, and then understand why was Yaakov successful? Not because of superstition, not because of idols, but because Yaakov was grounded in a real moral system connected to the Borei Olam. That's the truth. That idea could sustain Lavan and his family in the future as well. And that's part of the mission of the household of Avraham Avinu. That was Rachel's attempt. Unfortunately, it was misconstrued by her father, who only saw the zero-sum game, which is not that you stole my gods necessarily, but you took my possessions. Among my possessions you took the flock too, but now you intruded on my religious beliefs, which are sacrosanct to me. That Lavan was able to respond, so he did not really get the message that Rachel wanted to send, but that's the message she was sending. The whole Sedra really is a primer on rishus and greed, and specifically a specific type of rishus. We can recognize good either inherently or by exposing and identifying what evil is. But there are different types of rishon. And to think that every rush is the same is a gross mistake and a deadly mistake, because then we do not know how to combat that Russia. There's simple Rishoyim, and there's complex Rishoyim in the world as well. Is the Russia using the sledgehammer, the Russia of the brute force, and there's the Russia as well who's sophisticated, who doesn't use brute force, who uses words and ideas and values, corrupted as they are, but uses them. And that Russia is as dangerous, and sometimes even more dangerous, than the Russia who's animalistic. That's Kol Mashi'ir L'Avos Siman L'Banim. What happened to our fathers is really an indication of the way our lives will be. In exile here where Yaakov was, we want to return to Eretz Yisrael as well, because Lavan appears in many different guises. What's Yaakov's limud from this? What's our limud? That we use our chokhmah to serve Hashem, to protect our interests, to safeguard our values. We remain connected to the source of truth. That's Titein Emes L'Yaakov. We maintain our connection to the source of truth, and thereby we are servants of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. Yes? Why didn't he break the trumpet? That's a very good question. That's right. That's a good question. In fact, we picked this up in Shir many years ago, and there was no good answer that came forward. Now, we could speculate why she didn't. It could be that if you know they left in the dead of night, so to have broken them and tossed them aside, they could be found. I guess we could assume that Rachel would have disposed of them before they returned to Eretz Yisrael, once they had parted company with any of their pursuers. But what she would have done? She would have broken them and then done what? Then thrown them aside. And then they're found, looks even worse. Because now it looks like, that becomes a religious war. Looks like somebody, bemazed, took their god and smashed it. She couldn't just break it and throw it away. She had to break it and bury it, hide it, where it would never be found. And it could be there was no time to do that. So then she put them in a place she thought nobody would ever find them. She thought her father would never chase them, it's one thing, but she put them in a place where no one would ever look, in her own camp, personal, private saddlebag. All women should have a saddlebag, by the way, for their horses or donkeys, but that's where she put them. And ultimately, she would have disposed of them. But they were confronted pretty quickly, and she did not. Could be even she forgot about it while she had it, only thought about it when her father came. But in fact, I never saw an answer why she didn't destroy them. It just seems to me the most logical thing. She didn't, because she didn't have the time to do it. She didn't want it to be found, and she was waiting for a more opportune time. Yes?
I think her response, based on what you're saying about trying to enlighten her father one last time, when you pose the question of why does Yaakov go through this very odd, spotted sheep, salad sheep kind of thing, and it just set within as soon as you're going to pay me every year, there's no hashkacha practice in that. That Lavan is definitely providing for him. But by agreeing to that kind of whole scenario, it's a way that Yaakov perhaps at one point Lavan would say, well, how is it that the salads are getting spotted and vice versa? Lavan's too much of a rusher to recognize it, but he's that line of thinking follows Rachel's line of thinking in the Shiach and the Shemaya handles as well.
Yes. Well, you're correct, because Lavan did recognize something was unique. Nichashti, he said, Nichashti really is I'm superstitious. God, he said, has blessed me because of you. Now, Lavan understood God, of course, in a mystical, irrational way, in a superstitious way, as one who caters to human needs. But nevertheless, he did recognize there's a certain force. Now, Yaakov himself kept referring to that force. God has blessed you. And Chazal, of course, mentioned exactly what you say, that this was reliance on Hashgacha. But not because inherently he wanted to rely. And it could be that he wanted to propound and reinforce that lesson to Lavan as well. But I think the primary reason is because he knew that Lavan could not part with something. And therefore, to part with capital, something you have, would be very difficult for Lavan. And then that would just bring in his aggression. But here, Yaakov was trying to balance what he needed versus what his employer could give, and do it in such a way that the employer would come around. That it's not, you're not losing anything, you're gaining a little less. We're all gaining, but you're gaining a little less. But even that Lavan couldn't handle, and Yaakov eventually had to flee. Okay, I'm sorry, yes.